I'm Laura Mickus, and I am here with
Gary Lewis
and
Carmen Lefebvre.
And we're here to talk about a paper that they published recently in the Journal of Experimental Psychology General, and it's entitled Functional Architecture of Visual Emotion Recognition Ability, a Latent Variable Approach. Thank you for coming to be interviewed, and congratulations on your paper in one of the top journals of our field.
Cheers.
Cheers. Cheers. Oh, by the way, we're drinking two Frontiers and a white wine spritzer. It's a hot day out there. And we're in the bank in Clapham Junction, which is a very cool pub. Okay, on to the work. What I usually ask is, what was your question? Obviously has to do with emotion recognition, which is important for knowing if someone's mad at you or how to interact with people. But
okay, so yeah, you're absolutely right. If someone is glaring at you and you can't tell that that's what's going on, a bit like you're sort of doing now a little bit, like speak up, Gary, type of thing, you're going to be in trouble. So studying emotions and how people can recognize emotions has been important for yonks, many decades now, at least since the time of Darwin. What people have rarely done until recently and until the work we've done is actually look at differences in abilities to recognize emotions. So we know, for example, from many decades now that different cultures can recognize emotion expressions from one culture to another culture fairly well, very well in many cases. But we don't know about how well people in a given population differ in their abilities to recognize emotions and how those differences, for example, in the domain of the face, generalize to the body or things like the voice, which we haven't actually studied in this instance.
Right, and so that is a huge research question, and it's fitting because what you did was is large. You did look at face-specific emotions, body-specific emotions, and then something that you called supramodal.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you tell me a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, so you could think about this in the context of what's commonly studied in intelligence research. So you can imagine somebody might be very good, for example, at aspects of memory, for example, working memory type of tasks. Or they might be quite good at rotation, sort of rotating objects in their sort of mind's eye. Or they might be very good with vocabulary. So you might think of these as distinct abilities. But as people have found for decades, there seems to be general cognitive ability. So people who are good at one of those domains tend to be good at all of those domains. That
so
doesn't mean they're
correlated?
They're correlated, yeah. And in that instance, what you're getting is a sort of supramodal ability or supra-task ability.
Right.
And the same is true in the context of emotions. In principle, you might find that there's a face ability that people differ on and a body ability that people differ on, but there might actually be an ability which drives both of those domains sort of up or down.
Are people good at recognizing emotions in body language versus face? Or is there a difference? I would feel like those would go together, but I have no idea.
So the question is, are there some people who are really good at recognizing faces, others who are good at recognizing bodies?
That's a better, exactly.
In a classic neuropsychological context, a double dissociation between the two? I'm not sure, actually, if anyone's ever looked at that in a lesion, neuropsychological context.
Right.
But what you certainly get are differences between face ability and body ability.
You do get
they are differentiable. There is an overlap between them two, so they correlate.
Right.
And that's what we found. But they're also different as well.
Okay.
So there are multiple abilities, if you like, that underpin emotion recognition across different domains, like the face and the body. It isn't just one thing that lets you do, you know, better or worse across all of them.
Did you have a hypothesis or several hypotheses?
We had competing hypotheses that were driven by prevailing views in the literature, mainly driven by neuropsychological studies and lesion studies that have previously been looked at. And so the different models that we compared in our study were driven by that. And what was really nice is that we were able to identify one model that fit the data best. And in fact, that was also the model that most closely related to what's sort of previously been coming out of the literature most strongly.
Can you tell me how you went about testing your hypotheses? What was the method?
Okay, so this is the complicated stuff in some respects.
Okay.
So we use here a technique called structure equation modeling. I'm not going to go into the details because that'll be boring for people who are interested in just the sort of the nitty gritty, so to speak. A statistical technique that allows you basically to try and understand patterns of abilities in a data set. So you might imagine that, for example, let's say in reality, there were two or three different types of abilities that underpinned emotion recognition. Imagine there was a face ability and a body ability and a voice ability. So if you were sort of high on the face ability, you're really good at recognizing faces, face emotions. If you're really good on the body ability, you're really good at recognizing the body expressions of other people. So it's a technique that allows you to extract out how many factors or abilities exist. And it doesn't have to be three. It could be that there's just one across all of those different domains, or it could be more than that, depending on how your data has been set up. So it's a technique that's quite complex, but allows you, in essence, to understand how many different abilities exist across a range of cognitive tests.
To understand what's driving the recognition of emotions that's used. So participants were tested online.
They
looked at lots of stimuli of faces and bodies. Before we get more into that, thank you. That's a really good explanation of something really complex. So you want to tell me a bit about just what a participant would look at?
Our first difficult task was to actually create stimuli that would be what's called individual differences friendly. So one issue is that humans are actually incredibly good at detecting emotions. So, for example, even a sort of faint smile, most people pick up on and say, yes, this person is happy. And in order to detect differences between people, you need people to not perform at 100% or at ceiling, because then you can't detect any differences anymore. The challenge was to create stimuli that were quite difficult so that we would get a range in people's detection ability, I suppose. So for the face, what we did is we took really well-established emotion stimuli that showed the emotion at full bone intensity, and then morphed these with the same person having a neutral facial expression. And that way we could get different gradients of how intensive the emotion was displayed.
That's really well-controlled. Beautiful. Did you do the same for the body then?
So in the body it was a little bit different because our body stimuli were moving. Or at least most of our body stimuli were moving, movie clips, because typically bodies express emotions through some kind of pattern of motion. And moving bodies are not that straightforward to morph. And so what we did there is these were actors that acted out emotions at different levels of intensity. We didn't show the actual person as a full light, regular sort of video, but we actually only showed what are called point lights. So you only see the different joints of the body. For example, the knees and the elbows, and you see the head and approximately where the body is. So you can see the motion, but it's actually a little bit harder to detect.
Okay.
And that allowed us to select stimuli that people weren't as good at.
And by the way, you can see the head, the outline, but no expressions from the face in these stimuli.
Yeah.
It's just the body.
Confounded by that.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so then you do your structural equation modeling.
Yeah, so at this point we had several hundred people who took part in the study, so we've now got data on all these folk and how good they are at recognizing in the face and in the body these different emotion expressions, happy, sad, fear, and so on and so forth. And then you can model the data, then you can actually start to test different hypotheses about which, if you like, architecture most maps onto the observed data.
Can you tell me what you found?
So in a nutshell, to keep to the core, in essence what we find is evidence for a face-specific ability factor. And that's to say that there seems to be an ability factor that means you're either going to be better or worse, or you're at some point in the continuum of recognizing facial expressions.
Yeah.
But over and above that, or in addition to that, there was evidence for a supramodal factor. That is to say, a factor that seems to define where you lie in the continuum of recognizing emotions in general. In essence, what it means is that if you're good at recognizing emotions, if you're the person who can walk into the pub and recognize emotions from your friends or the barman really well, it could be because you're very good at this face-specific factor, or in essence, you're a high scorer on that face factor. It could be because you're a high scorer on that supramodal factor, or a combination of the two, in fact. There are multiple systems that underpin how good your emotion recognition abilities are, and here we're able to tease them apart and show how they, if you like, are independent components of the emotion recognition system.
So if I'm good at recognizing happy, I'd be good at recognizing sad too, and that's the idea behind supramodal?
Well, the supramodal is across modalities, not across emotions as such.
Oh,
so the face factor,
that's a silly question.
Well, no, it's a key question actually. So it's relevant though in the face context. So the face specific factor is basically saying that if you're good at recognizing happy faces, on average you're also good at recognizing sad faces and angry faces. The supermodal factor is basically identifying that if you're good at generally recognizing emotions in the face, you're probably also going to be the individual who's good at recognizing them from the body.
Right.
So it's a cross-modality. That's the key point there.
And did you find Gaussian distributions in ability?
Yeah, in essence, they're normally distributed.
Yeah,
so
nice.
Some are good, some are very good, some are really not so good, and you're seeing people in between all of those points in the continuum.
Do you know if people who are good at recognizing emotions are also very expressive?
In the paper, we actually have got an analysis that speaks to that somewhat. So there's a concept called alexithymia.
Right.
And what alexithymia is this idea that some people are better at understanding, if you like, the emotional states they're experiencing, and that they're better at labeling the context that they're feeling.
We're in a quiet room where there's a large screen TV, and we were just kicked out of there, so we've moved spots around to a louder spot in the bank. So let's pick up where we were. You were talking about alexithymia?
Alexithymia. Yeah. So alexithymia is a concept that captures differences in people's ability to recognize the emotion they're feeling at a given moment in time. So alexi, sort of word from the original root, a means without. So in essence, what it means is if you're a high scorer in alexithymia, you're somebody who has a limited vocabulary to describe what you're feeling. That doesn't mean that these people don't know what angry means. They know the dictionary definition of words. They have a full vocabulary,
right.
But what they struggle with is labeling the feeling they have at a given moment in time. So they might know that they're feeling a little bit sort of negatively, their negative affect might be quite high, but they can't necessarily pinpoint very well whether it's anxiety,
right.
Or anger. So that there's a degree of sort of confusion in that sense. And what we did was we measured alexithymia in this study, and we found that people who are lower on alexithymia, so people who have, in a sense,
better
internal knowledge of their emotional states, are better at recognizing emotions in other people.
You also looked at autism measures.
Mm-hmm. The basic finding that's pretty robust, although people do argue about this a little bit, is that people who have autism tend to be poorer at social cognition in sort of fairly specific senses sometimes, and one of them seems to be the ability to recognize emotions in others. But what hadn't been well studied until we looked at this, and there's been a little bit of work as well but beyond our study, is whether this deficit, if you like, in person perception operates at the level of the face, or whether it's a supramodal deficit. So you could imagine that an autistic individual is generally bad at emotion recognition, and that would implicate the supramodal factor.
Right.
Or it could be a specific face thing for some reason or other.
Yeah.
So what we found actually was evidence here that autism-like traits, so this wasn't studies of individuals with diagnosed autism, but individuals in the normal population who vary on autistic-like traits.
Right.
Individuals with more autistic-like traits were poor at face emotion recognition, but the supramodal factor wasn't really a component of that.
That's
of that story.
Fascinating. Were you surprised by that?
A little bit surprised that there's some work that suggests that you might have found the opposite to
right.
that. But it's early days. So this is a literature that's...
there's little work done.
Yeah.
Oh,
so it's a contribution.
Cool.
But I wouldn't say that it's the final story
right.
at this point.
And you also looked at general intelligence too in experiment 3.
Mm-hmm.
And you found that people who scored higher on general intelligence were better at recognizing emotion.
Exactly, yeah. People who do better at a general cognitive task of reasoning and thinking were also people who were supramodal, in supramodal terms, better at emotion recognition.
This might surprise some people who work with academics.
Yeah. wasn't that high a correlation?
Right.
But about a 0.3 or 0.4 correlation.
Oh,
so
okay.
One doesn't explain the other.
Okay.
So that gets the academics off the hook in a sense.
Is there anything else you'd like to talk about?
I wonder if... was back to the start, we actually didn't really mention that there are these five basic emotions. We study them, and there are some studies that look at far more differences in emotions.
Yeah.
But there are these five that seem to be quite universally present.
Can you tell me them?
So they are happiness, disgust, fear, sadness, and anger.
Why are so many of them negative?
Well, all but happiness are negative, you're right. I suppose there is only a need for one way of expressing when you feel good, whereas versus in negative terms, there might be a necessity to differentiate why something is bad. So, for example, when you're fearful, you might want to transmit to other people, it's time to run away because something is happening. Whereas if you're angry, you're transmitting, I'm angry, I might hit you. And that's quite a different message to get across. Whereas happiness is basically just about, oh, we're in a good place and, you know, we all like each other. There isn't really a need for as much differentiation. And it's maybe worth also mentioning surprise. So surprise is...
You did not include surprise.
No, we did not include surprise. And that's because surprise is a little contested in several ways. So one is that it's not entirely clear whether surprise is part of these basic emotions quite in the same way. So it does also seem to be relatively universal, but not quite as well underpinned as the other five.
Right.
And surprise also has this funny component that is it can be both positive and negative.
Yeah.
And so you could actually think about surprise as perhaps being two separate types of emotions that come out in the same way.
Right.
And so we were thinking that it might actually have a slightly different way of being recognized because it doesn't clearly fit into these two camps, and we've ignored it for that reason for now.
Right. So for now. So does that mean in the future you will look into...
It's possible. It might be, I mean, one future avenue could be to explore further emotions that go beyond the basic five.
Yeah.
So while these are universal and really core to human interaction, there are clearly a lot of other emotions, things like affection and love, and so there are some more positive emotions.
Right.
For you,
thank you.
That might also be interesting to study and look at some point.
Yeah. Is that what else for the future? Are you working on any follow-ups beyond this?
Yeah, lots of stuff really. So it's an area that's pretty underexplored, so there's lots of room for other types of work. We are looking to start some work on voice emotion recognition, how that relates to these visual inputs that we've already studied. Interested in understanding how these types of abilities relate to other social inferences, so what's known as gaze cueing. So, for example, if somebody's eye gaze moves in one direction, people pick that up quite easily, but not everybody is as attentive as others. So does that type of social cognitive ability relate?
Individual differences in that aspect
exactly. So really a broader program of research looking at social cognitive differences and how they relate to emotion recognition differences.
Very cool. I guess we'll wrap it up there.
Okay.
Thank you so much, and I really love the work. It's super fascinating. I'm going to look up all about alexithymia. All right, and cheers. Thanks so much.
Cheers, Laura.
Cheers. Thank you.